In 1946, in Paris, France, a Hungarian by the name of Elmer Dahori sold a Picasso drawing to Britain's Lady Malcolm Campbell for a little less than $100. Shortly thereafter, Dahori began selling other Picassos to art galleries around Paris. He explained that his parents had been aristocratic Jews killed in the Holocaust, and the remarkable pieces of artwork were remnants of their vast estate prior to imprisonment. Using some of his proceeds, Dahori traveled around selling other pieces of artwork for even larger sums. At times he worked with sales partners, other times Dahori sold on his own. He moved to the United States, ultimately settling in Miami, Florida in 1950, where Dahori worked as an art dealer. He sold Picassos, but also works from Matisse, Renoir, and Modigliani. Not just drawings, but expensive oil paintings too. Some of his clients included Texas oil baron Alger H. Meadows, the Fogg Art Museum at Harvard University, the National Museum of Western Art in Tokyo, and actress Zsa Zsa Gabor. There was just one major problem with business. Elmer Dahori created all those masterpieces himself. A big key to Dahori's long success was that, unlike most other art forgers, he didn't reproduce existing works, but rather drew and painted brand new pieces in the style of the great artists he was imitating. Reproducing an existing masterpiece means easy exposure if potential clients know the whereabouts of the original or ever come across it. But another part of Dahori's success was that he often used pseudonyms and sold artwork through the mail. That's why he was able to continue peddling forgeries even after the museum at Harvard University figured out they had a fake, as did other of Dahori's customers. Authorities tried to investigate the forger's trail, but for many years, Dahori stayed just one or more steps ahead of them. Obviously, in addition to being a consummate con man, Dahori was an amazing artist in his own right. While running from the law, he expanded his repertoire to styles of other sought-after artists, like Chagall, Toulouse-Lautrec, Degas, among others. Many of Dahori's fakes were even featured in art books in which they were attributed to the great masters he copied. Brokers and galleries that unknowingly purchased Dahori's forgeries were selling them to others at top dollar, far in excess of what he had been paid for them. The forger began to consider how little he'd been paid for his fakes versus how much they could command. At times, Dahori struggled to become a celebrity artist in his own right, but continued to find more success in forgery. His life was marked by stormy personal relationships, including his associates in the con game who cheated him out of millions of dollars, leaving him nearly broke. He suffered through occasional legal battles when deceptions were detected and ultimately a failed suicide attempt. In 1962, Dahori moved to the island of Ibiza off the coast of Spain. There he continued to dabble in art forgery, but the quality of his fakes declined to the point where they were much less passable as authentic. While living in Ibiza, Dahori and his criminal associates were more or less outlaws. On and off, as various law enforcement agencies, including Interpol, investigated him, Dahori was on the run throughout Europe. But eventually, he decided to return to Spain and face the music. Even though the Spanish courts tried to convict him of numerous charges, Dahori wound up with only 2 months in jail. That was because no one could prove he actually created any of the fraudulent artwork within Spanish borders. There were also questions about the legality of even calling his works forgeries, because Dahori rarely signed them with the name of the artist he was imitating. It's not illegal to duplicate the style of another artist. Dahori merely peddled them as authentic. His crimes made Dahori infamous. And once he was released from prison, the value of his forgeries actually increased. Not only that, but his celebrity created a public interest in Dahori's own artwork, something he had longed for his entire life. He appeared on television shows, hobnob with the likes of Marlene Dietrich, Ursula Andress, Marilyn Monroe, Liz Taylor, Montgomery Clift, and Rita Hayworth. The author and investigative reporter Clifford Irving wrote Dahori's biography in 1969. It was titled Fake, the story of Elmire de Hoorie, the greatest art forger of our time. In 1974, Orson Welles created a documentary about de Hoorie called F is for Fake. But the noose tightened around his decades of forgery in international circles, and when de Hoorie found himself faced with criminal extradition to France in late 1976, he took an overdose of sleeping pills and ended his life. It's unknown how many forgeries the man created, or how many are still out there in circulation and presumed authentic. Some estimate his total sales exceeded $100 million, but he died nearly broke due to unfair business partners combined with de Hoorie's own propensity for a lavish lifestyle. First and foremost, de Hoorie's works were not readily identified as forgeries because he was that good of an artist. Plus, as I mentioned earlier, de Hoorie didn't reproduce existing works. He made his own. But just as importantly, forensic science itself was not nearly as state-of-the-art, pun intended, in the middle of the 20th century like it is now. Even if stylistic qualities of a forgery pass muster, today's sophisticated chemical and physical testing should easily expose a fake. For instance, the ability to test paints and canvases for their chemical constituents and their age, well, that's one of the prime means of identifying materials that are inconsistent with the time or place in which a fake was allegedly produced. There are three main categories of art fraud. One is what de Hoorie routinely did, make a piece of artwork and play it off as created by someone famous. Another category is what some of the galleries or investors did once they found out they had a de Hoorie, and that is to know a piece of artwork is a fraud, but sell it as an original. Galleries and art investors need to turn a profit, so if they discover a ruse, but then pretend a forged piece is authentic, well, they might easily get away with resale, especially if they act fast. The gallery owners might sell a forgery for far less than what they paid for it just to unload it before they're caught or stuck with it, since having the public find out a gallery was duped could ruin its reputation. The third main art forgery category is when someone finds an existing piece of artwork and decides to credit it to someone they know was not the artist in order to sell it for a high price. Now, there's a long history of what could be thought of as art forgery, and the legalities are not often clear. The first known examples were ancient Romans who copied artwork from Greece. Later, during the Renaissance, master artists had numerous apprentices working under them, and all the collective works were signed and attributed to the master. There really wasn't anything fraudulent about that. But as time has gone on, that practice has sometimes made it difficult for authenticators to know for certain which, among a group of signed works, was actually from the master and not of his apprentice. By the end of the Renaissance, though, plenty of artists were creating pieces they claimed were from the great masters. And that was the true beginning of illegal art fraud. Here's an interesting twist, though. Salvador Dali signed his name to thousands of pieces of paper and then gave them away, allowing other people to create artwork on them. In fact, because of this unusual practice, some art investigators believe an unsigned Dali is more likely authentic than one with his signature on it. Now, here's another good story. In 1985, John Myatt, a struggling art teacher in England, was raising his two young children alone when a friend offered to pay him to reproduce a famous painting. Later, Myatt's friend remarked that the copy was so good that it was fooling many people who saw it. So to raise cash, Myatt put an ad in a London magazine indicating he would create 19th and 20th century fakes on request for a cost of $240 each. Now, he wasn't intending to defraud anyone. He just needed money. A con man named John Drew put in an order for some masterpieces by Myatt, and he was so impressed that he persuaded Myatt to work with him and try to pass the fakes off as originals. Myatt's artwork wasn't really that great. I mean, he was no de Hoorie. But Drew's ability to fake the provenance of the works was what allowed the pair to sell over 200 fake masterpieces. Drew was able to gain entry to famous art museums and art houses where he would steal dealer stamps and gallery labels and change auction records. The strategy allowed the pair to fool dealers and collectors, including at several of London's best art museums. Now, Drew even used fake names or names of dead people as previous holders of the paintings to show a chronology of ownership, even bribing an old friend who needed money to pose as an art dealer and sign false documents for Drew. In the mid-1980s, there was a huge interest in buying artwork as an investment, so the pair's timing was perfect. They were even able to fool experts at the famous Christie's and Sotheby's auction houses. When Myatt heard how much his fakes were going for, he ramped up his game by using an emulsion that helped the paint dry faster, so he could produce even more quickly. Even that didn't catch the experts' eyes for several years. But eventually, after almost 10 years of scamming the art world, authorities got suspicious. When they visited Myatt at his home, he confessed. He implicated Drew as well. Myatt and Drew were arrested, tried, and in February of 1999 were convicted. Myatt served only 4 months and Drew 2 years, but the damage was done. Of the over 200 paintings the pair sold, less than half have been recovered. Now, Myatt ended up a veritable celebrity, hosting a couple of his own TV series about art. He's also worked with Scotland Yard on methods to help detect art forgery. An important consideration in authenticating any piece of art is that the methods used be as non-invasive as possible. Considering the analysis of paintings, for example, there are 3 main steps in forgery investigation, usually undertaken in order. The exam begins with the surface of the painting. Optical microscopy, often called light microscopy, in the magnification range of about 5 to 50 times, well, that allows a forgery expert to view the details of tiny cracks that naturally form on paint over time. This will let them judge whether the cracks are authentic, were accelerated using solvents, or were even merely drawn on the surface. When ultraviolet light is applied to a painting's surface, old layers of varnish will dramatically fluoresce, while newer paint on a retouched or forged painting will not. Now, if the surface exam doesn't easily weed out a fake, investigators dive deeper into the background, or what's known as the underpainting of a piece. Artists commonly reuse canvases over time, whether masters or frauds. Conventional medical x-rays and infrared analysis can see through layers of paint and detect earlier artwork created on the same background. When using x-rays, the film is placed in front of the painting and the x-ray shot from behind to reveal any underpainting. Infrared light can also be applied to the surface and then reflected back to a light-sensitive camera that can capture subsurface painting or even prior charcoal drawings. If the styles don't match, especially if the background art is of a type that came into fashion later than the foreground, they can suspect forgery. The last step undertaken is an examination of the mediums used in the body of the surface painting. Polarized light microscopy is a basic way to analyze pigments in paint or even ink. On the other hand, X-ray diffraction studies, which look at how a given medium bends X-rays, can reveal the actual crystalline structure of components within pigments. Now, some types of crystalline pigments were only discovered and incorporated into paint during a certain era. So if they're used to fake an old master, X-ray diffraction studies can expose the fraud. Techniques called X-ray fluorescence and neutron activation can take authenticators down to the most basic chemical level. In X-ray fluorescence, the object being examined is bathed with radiation, and the pattern of X-rays it emits reveals its elemental breakdown. Neutron activation relies on the use of energized neutrons to bombard the sample, causing some of the atoms in the analyzed substance to take up a neutron and become radioactive isotopes. As these newly created isotopes then decay, they send out gamma rays that identify which elements are present in the paint or other medium. Radiocarbon dating, which also relies on the decay of radioisotopes, can be used to estimate the age of organic constituents, whether that's canvas, paint, or other carbon-containing media. But part of the sample has to be destroyed during the dating, and it only works in the range of about 50,000 to 400 years ago. When analysis of 3D artwork is required, CT scanning, more formally known as computed axial tomography, can allow internal views of objects like sculptures. Magnetic resonance imagery, commonly called MRI, can reveal the internal aspects of ceramics, bronzes, and wooden sculptures. But one of the problems with nearly all these high-tech methods, except maybe the optical microscopy, is that the painting or other object has to be brought to the lab or to a medical facility. A new method called molecular Raman spectroscopy relies on lasers to identify both non-organic and organic pigments, as well as binders used in paint. This technique is overtaking X-ray diffraction studies since it can be performed in the field and is completely non-destructive. One of the easiest ways to detect a forgery is to show that anything used to create it was not available in the place or the time the artwork was allegedly created. If a given type of wood, clay, paint, or other natural material was not available in the region or period the artwork is claimed to be from, it's a fake. Just like other criminal enterprises, though, people intent on forgery will try to find a way around any known investigative tools. Can you believe in 1496, Michelangelo himself buried a sculpture he made of Cupid to allow the acidic soil to age it? Even during the Renaissance, ancient artwork was still hugely popular and could command more money. The cardinal he sold it to found out about the artificial aging technique, but he let young Michelangelo keep some of the profit because he recognized the man's talent. And Elmire de Hori, our master forger, well, he deliberately took blank pages from vintage sketchbooks to use for his drawings. He also visited flea markets to purchase old low-cost paintings so he could scrape off the paint and use the aged canvases to make his own oil paintings. In 2011, the New York Times reported that the man who had been living with de Hori when he died, named Mark Forgy, a name ironically only one letter away from the word forge, well, he was working with a Paris art historian to uncover more about de Hori's life. Forgy had kept boxes of de Hori's documents, including legal paperwork and false passports, but now decided to share them with the world. Birth records and other documents from Budapest, Hungary, were found that dispelled some of the myths set forth in Clifford Irving's biography of de Hori. The research also led to the discovery of new works from the master forger located in an attic in western France. The team plans to send some of de Hori's pieces for high-tech analysis to create what they've called a, quote, forensic footprint of his work. Now, that may help define de Hori's methods, and then that forensic footprint can be used for comparison to other suspected forgeries of his that are probably still in circulation. De Hori's story doesn't even end there. Beginning in 2014, some of his artwork, along with pieces from dozens of other forgers, became part of a traveling exhibition called Intent to Deceive, Fakes and Forgeries in the Art World. The exhibition was created by the organization International Arts and Artists, headquartered in Washington, D.C. The curator of the exhibit, Colette Marvin, is the same art historian who worked with de Hori's companion, Mark Forgy, to document the artist's deception. Interestingly, Marvin is also a trainer for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Cultural Heritage Protection Program. In that regard, she helps teach federal agents the more esoteric, in other words, non-scientific and stylistic ways that art historians look for forgery. That way, they can still combat art fraud within or coming into or out of the U.S. without resorting to costly high-tech methods. Now, let's look at what I think is a really interesting twist off the Elmire de Hori story. Remember I said that the American news reporter and author Clifford Irving wrote de Hori's biography? This was because the pair were neighbors in 1962 on the Spanish island of Ibiza. That's where Irving lived with his third wife and then later his fourth. After de Hori was exposed, the forger asked Irving to write a biography of his exceptional life And in 1969, McGraw-Hill published Irving's book. Well, Clifford Irving has a relevant story of his own I'd like to tell. The year after his biography of the Master Forger was published, Irving contacted his editors at McGraw-Hill. He told them that in an unbelievable stroke of luck, the reclusive billionaire Howard Hughes had recently contacted him. Irving said after reading the DeHoury biography he'd written, Hughes had decided to ask Irving to likewise serve as his biographer. At the enthusiastic invitation from McGraw-Hill, Irving flew to New York and presented three letters from Hughes. Within these letters, Hughes stated there were far too many rumors and inaccuracies in circulation regarding his unusual life, both before and after he'd gone into his self-imposed seclusion. The reclusive billionaire wanted these misconceptions cleared up before he died, but wanted the project to remain a secret until publication, with all contact passing through Clifford Irving only. Now, McGraw-Hill trusted Irving. He'd been a successful writer with their organization for over 10 years. But just to be sure that Irving wasn't being scammed by somebody, the publishing house decided to have a forensic document examiner look over the letters from Hughes. They took the paperwork to the Osborne Associates, a nationally recognized company that specialized in the authentication of handwriting and documents. Their expert judged the signature to be from Hughes. Now, the assessment satisfied McGraw-Hill, and the Hughes biography project went forward. Now, most people know plenty about Howard Hughes, but just in case you don't, let me give you a few highlights of his remarkable life. Howard R. Hughes, Jr. was born in 1905 near Houston, Texas, the only child of a man who became a millionaire developing technology used in oil well drilling. Hughes, Jr. was said to be introverted, creative, and very talented. At age 18, he was orphaned and inherited three-fourths of his father's company and wealth. A year later, Hughes married and moved to Hollywood, where his uncle was a screenwriter. Hughes eventually became a successful movie producer, launching the careers of numerous Hollywood stars. Affairs with various actresses ultimately ended his marriage. While in Hollywood, Hughes hired a man named Noah Dietrich as his accountant and personal business manager, building a relationship that lasted more than 30 years. Dietrich's name will come up again shortly. Hughes got his pilot's license and in the early 1930s created the Hughes Aircraft Company. He became a world-renowned aviator, and his engineering led to many innovations in the aircraft industry. In 1942, Hughes was commissioned to design and build a wooden seaplane for use in World War II. It was nicknamed the Spruce Goose. Unfortunately, it wasn't finished until 1947, after the war was over, and Hughes flew it only once. Hughes moved to Las Vegas, where throughout the 1950s he lived and conducted business on the top floor of the Desert Inn Hotel. He began buying up various casinos and hotels in Vegas and continued in other ventures, like RKO Pictures and TWA Airlines. But he was becoming more and more reclusive. Among other rumored maladies, Hughes was thought to have suffered from obsessive-compulsive disorder. And as time went on, severe psychosis and mental deterioration, some say possibly from syphilis. Throughout the 1960s until his death in 1976, Hughes lived in seclusion with a small entourage. He moved from one hotel penthouse to another between Las Vegas, Beverly Hills, Boston, London, Acapulco, Managua, Nassau, and other cities, typically only leaving the hotel to move somewhere else. Now, given that spectacular life and all of his accomplishments and idiosyncrasies, Hughes was definitely someone of public interest, especially after his seclusion began. Hughes became even more of an enigma as rumors circulated about his increasingly bizarre behaviors throughout the 1960s and 70s. So it was no wonder that once Hughes' handwriting had been authenticated, McGraw-Hill jumped on the biography proposal. They gave Irving a contract for himself and another one for Hughes to sign. The publisher offered Irving a decent advance, but he bargained for even more, $100,000 for himself and $750,000 for Hughes. But as I said before in this lecture, there was just one big problem. Irving had completely concocted this whole scheme in conjunction with fellow author Richard Susskind. The guy who had just finished writing the biography of one of the greatest forgers of all time decided to perpetrate his own artistic fraud in the form of a book. Maybe DeHorey's story was Irving's inspiration. Irving had gotten another artist friend, not DeHorey, to forge all three of the letters he presented to the publisher. The artist designed the documents using a sample of the recluse's writing that had appeared in a 1970 Newsweek article that was titled The Case of the Invisible Billionaire. Both Irving and Susskind were banking on the assumption that Hughes would not come out of seclusion and probably wouldn't learn of the pending publishing deal. So Irving took the McGraw-Hill contract for Hughes and forged the recluse's signature on it. Next, with the help of his wife, Irving figured out how to get the money he negotiated for Hughes. They got Mrs. Irving a false passport in the name of Helga R. Hughes and instructed McGraw-Hill that checks for the project were to be made out to H. R. Hughes. Edith Irving then signed as Helga R. Hughes and deposited the funds into a Swiss bank account. Irving and Susskind began their research and hit pay dirt in Palm Springs, California, the resort town Hughes had frequented for nearly 30 years before his seclusion. There, Irving ran into a friend of his, Hollywood producer Stanley Meyer, who coincidentally happened to be trying to get a memoir of Noah Dietrich published. Remember, Dietrich was Hughes' accountant and friend. Now, Dietrich had been working with a young journalist on the project, but Irving's friend Meyer suggested Dietrich get a more seasoned author to really, quote, polish it up. While Dietrich was searching for his new writer, Meyer secretly copied the manuscript and gave it to Irving. The Dietrich memoir was full of biographical information about Howard Hughes. Also while in Palm Springs, Irving and Susskind got their hands on three boxes of material about Hughes, which his former publicity agent had donated to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts. So Irving had plenty of factual information to work from to build his phony biography, and he filled in the rest with lies. He told McGraw-Hill he got the information by interviewing Hughes at several undisclosed locations. Later, Irving confessed the trips were really excuses to rendezvous with his lover. Irving and Susskind rushed to get their manuscript to McGraw-Hill before Noah Dietrich was any the wiser. By fall of 1971, they had a manuscript of over 1,000 pages. In December of that year, McGraw-Hill announced to the public what they had. Shortly after the announcement, journalist Frank McCullough from Time Life, who was the last person known to interview the recluse in 1958, he got an angry phone call from a man claiming to be Hughes. The caller said the book was a hoax and that he never even met Clifford Irving. McCullough was a Hughes expert, and when he read the manuscript, McCullough found the information to be pretty factual. When Irving was questioned about the contact allegedly from Hughes, he said the caller was clearly an imposter. McGraw-Hill asked Irving to take a lie detector test, and although the results were deemed inconclusive, they showed no, quote, concrete lies. Following the coverage of all these events in the news, Hughes surfaced. He announced that on January 7, 1972, he would hold a teleconference to be recorded by seven journalists and then aired at a later date. The reporters, who were all familiar with Hughes, questioned him for about 20 minutes. Anticipating more Irving denials, NBC hired voice print expert Lawrence Kersta, and he was to forensically compare the recording of Hughes' 1972 call to previously recorded audio of him. Now, Kersta acquired a 30-year-old tape that was known to be of Hughes' voice. That recording was converted to a spectrogram that could measure tone, pitch, and other voice elements. Using this technology, Kersta concluded the voice on the 1972 teleconference belonged to Hughes and no one else. In the meantime, Irving's story continued to unravel. He tried to play the whole affair off as an experiment he had drummed up, more or less as an adventure in fraud that he could write about. Within weeks of the teleconference, though, Irving and his wife admitted to both the hoax and the check forgery, and Susskind wasn't far behind. Ultimately, they faced several state and federal charges, including mail fraud, forgery, and perjury for lying in a sworn affidavit. Clifford pled guilty and was sentenced to 2.5 years, but served only 17 months. Susskind ended up serving only 5 months. For her part, Edith Irving served just 2 months in America, but also wound up with a bank fraud sentence in Switzerland that was suspended. Question documents like letters, wills, ransom notes, and manuscripts have a long forensic history, similar to the analysis of art forgeries. The examination of handwriting styles has been used to authenticate documents for centuries, as have been the brush strokes of the great masters, or those who try to imitate them. Chemical and physical laboratory testing of inks and papers mirrors those used on prints, paints, and canvas. And media found to post-date the time a document was allegedly produced is a dead giveaway to fraud. The perpetration of art and document forgeries also shares something else in common. Both are creative efforts of con men and women determined to make money by deceiving someone else.